What is the eraser? Forget to take this one. Yeah, but this I cannot reach. No, I just. Okay, so what we saw so far is the prediction, I mean, the explicit formula for the scalar spectrum of perturbation. So scalar in the sense that we are talking about, you should think about this as perturbation, scalar perturbation of the surfaces of constant inflaton, and in the present universe, fluctuation of the surface of constant temperature, for example. Now, so in the Lagrangian that we saw yesterday, there is the Einstein-Hilbert term for gravity, and then there is a scalar field. So we expect clearly that there is another degree of freedom, which are gravitational waves. So the story with gravitational waves is very, very simple, even simpler than for the scalar case. So let me just quote the result. So the story is very simple because if you remember when you study gravitational waves, once you choose a gauge, the kinetic, I mean, if you look at the action, the quadratic action for gravitational waves, it's just of the form dH squared. So it just behaves like a scalar field, massless. Okay. And so the calculation that we did for a massless scalar field in the sitter applies with some index added, but which just we do not care. So at the end, you get exactly the same result. So you get that if I call gamma the gravitational wave, clearly we know that there are two polarization, so there is an index describing the polarization. But the correlation between two gravitational waves with different case and different polarization is given by a formula similar to the one we saw. So there is the conservation of momentum. Then there is a delta of SS prime, in the sense that only gravitational waves with the same polarization are correlated, because two different polarization, they behave at different fields. So at linear level, there is no correlation. So there is only correlation among the same polarization. And then there is the result that we saw, h squared over 2k cubed. Okay. And then there is a factor, there is a factor 2 over n Planck squared, which just comes from the normalization of kinetic term, because in the Einstein-Hilbert action, there is an n Planck squared over 2 in front. So I have to take into account this to properly normalize my two-point function. So you see that this is, as it mass is dimensionless, so this amplitude is dimensionless. As it must. So we see that the amplitude of the spectrum of gravitational waves goes like as h over n Planck squared, compared to the one of zeta that we saw, which goes on the other end like this squared. So you see what we said yesterday, that the scalar spectrum is always enhanced compared to the gravitational wave one by factor 1 over square root of epsilon. And depending on how big this is, it can give this can be very suppressed or slightly suppressed compared to the scalar modes. Okay. How do we measure gravitational waves? Well, so far we didn't measure it. We only have limits on the presence of gravitational waves. The most promising way to measure gravitational waves, we are talking about gravitational waves on huge wavelength, comparable to the present or the present Hubble radius. So nothing to do with the detection of gravitational waves from astrophysical sources. To detect gravitational waves of order of the Hubble radius, again, we can use the CMB. The CMB fluctuations are also sourced by gravitational waves. And the interesting thing is that given the polarization properties of gravitational waves, they leave a distinctive signature in the CMB. In particular, they create a kind of polarization, which is called B-modes, which is absent if you only consider scalar modes. Okay, so when people talk about B-mode, B-modes are considered a smoking gun of gravitational waves because it's a kind of polarization which can only be created by gravitational waves. Clearly, these without other contaminations like lensing and so on. But in principle, this is a very robust signature. Okay, let's give a look at the present experimental situation. So you saw many plots like this probably many times. So on the horizontal axis, there is an S, which is the deviation from scale invariance of the scalar spectrum. On the y-axis, there is R. R, given or taken some factor of order one, is just the ratio between the two contributions, the gravitational wave contribution and the scalar one. So you see that data are compatible with zero gravitational waves, so there is no evidence of gravitational waves. There is, as I said, a rather convincing evidence that the scale invariant spectrum is ruled out. This is something like 95% confidence level. But still, to do a plot like this, we have to put a lot of information, and I think we have to wait a bit to be completely sure. But as I said, I think that this would be a robust, the deviation from scale invariance is a very important smoking gun of inflation, because it tells me that is a smoking gun of a de Sitter which is perturbed in such a way that it leads to the end, it leads to a decelerating universe. So you see many models on this plot. For example, there is our friend M squared phi squared, which are this line here. Notice that predictions for a given model, they depend also on N. The reason is quite clear, because so when I calculate, for example, the tilt of a spectrum, okay, so this quantity depends, these two quantities are not exactly constant, but they depend on the position on the potential. In particular, for the model M squared phi squared, you can easily calculate them. And this turns out to be minus 2 over n. Is an exercise that you can do. You just use the formulas of Sroll to relate epsilon and eta to the number of e-folds to the end of inflation. So these numbers are slowly varying, but they depend on n. They depend on the amount of inflation that you have. And as we discussed, this number depends logarithmically on, for example, the reheating temperature, on the reheating temperature. And this is not well known. Well, it's completely not well known. So each model in this plot gives a line, and changing the number of e-folds, I get different predictions. So you see that the two dots are for n equal to 50 and n equal to 60. Okay, so the larger is big N, the closer you are to a scale invariant spectrum, because this goes like 2 over N. Okay. But you see that the situation is very promising, in the sense that you see some of the model, like lambda phi to the fourth, is already excluded. You have to take it with some grain of salt, but it depends on which experiment you consider and so on. But we are really reaching a precision that is able to rule out some of the models. What else? Well, again, in this plot, all these are quote-unquote high energy models. Okay, so all the models, like hybrid models that I was talking about yesterday, they would lie here on this line because the contribution of gravitational waves is tremendously small. Okay, so this is a bit misleading in the sense that we are only describing here models at high energy, while all the low energy models will just give a negligible production of gravitational waves. Yes.
The correlation function.
Yeah.
Why is detection of R not exactly a measurement of epsilon?
It is.
It is? So it's the same.
Yes. No, it is. Yeah, it is just a definition that people, they could use epsilon,
Okay.
It would be the same. Yes, yeah. Well, you know, it's true that this prediction, all what I did is in a precise context. For example, one can complicate the business, changing the Hilbert Lagrangian, adding additional fields. So if you want, this R is an observational quantity, which corresponds, can be written as a function of epsilon in this particular simple set, more in general. Okay. Other things that I want to mention is that okay, that probably in the future we hope to get back to get to a level of gravitational waves of order 0.01, so something at this level. Beyond this, it's very difficult to conceive any experiments able to measure gravitational waves. Let me conclude. Another quantity that you can calculate is the tilt of the gravitational wave spectrum. Again, you can say the same thing as we did for the scalar spectrum. Also, gravitational waves becomes constant out of the Hubble radius, so also these must be calculated at horizon crossing. So also these depends slightly on k through this dependence. So you can calculate the quantity nt. By definition and by historical reasons, now there is no minus one. So nt equal to zero means a scale invariant spectrum of gravitational waves. And nt, using the same formula as before, turns out to be, I mean, here it's simpler because there is only h squared, and this turns out to be minus 2 epsilon. Okay, so the tilt of gravitational wave spectrum is always red, okay, because it is only sensitive to h, and h is always decreasing in during inflation. Okay. One thing that I forgot to mention is that I want to emphasize the importance of gravitational waves for inflation. As you see from this formula, gravitational waves are tremendously simple. Gravitational waves are just sensitive to H to H. Okay? They are just sensitive. They don't care about there are two fields, one field, what these fields are doing. They are just sensitive to the cosmological background. So they are very, very robust from this point of view. They are really considered the final smoking gun of inflation, in the sense that if you see gravitational waves, you see that the universe was at a very, that the Hubble parameter was very, very large in the primordial era. And this, for example, as Jean-Luc discussed, cannot be obtained in alternative to inflation, in the sense that it's something very robust because it has just had to do with the cosmological background, and it doesn't depend on the details of what is the Lagrangian for the scalar fields and so on. So it's something very, very robust. Unfortunately, as I said many times, it's not obvious that even if inflation is correct, there is no, I mean, it's possible that we have a low energy model and the gravitational wave background is too suppressed to be measured. So this is the tilt of the gravitational wave spectrum. People notice that now there is a consistency check if you want. So if you are able to measure gravitational waves, and you're also able to measure the tilt of a gravitational wave spectrum, which is very difficult even in the cases of high energy inflation, because clearly to see this tilt is very challenging. But if you're able to do so, you notice that this epsilon is fixed, in a sense, it's fixed by R. No? So both the ratio between the gravitational wave and the scalar and the tilt of the gravitational wave spectrum is given as a function of epsilon. So if you want, once you measure the level of gravitational waves, you have a prediction for the tilt that you can check. So this consistency relation would be a very nice check of the whole business. But again, even if you are optimistic, this is very, very difficult to realize, at least in the near future. Okay. So,
yeah, this is
a very good question. In fact, it's possible to have contamination. For example, in these models of brain inflation, in which you produce cosmic strings, generate B modes because generate this kind of polarization, which is usually associated with the gravitational waves. So there is the risk of confusion between the two. Yes, this is a good point. Yes, all I say is in an ideal world, but clearly there are many complications that can enter in the game. In particular, also B-mode polarization is generated by lensing, and this creates a background to detection of primordial gravitational waves. Okay, so any other? Okay, I'm not completely sure what I want to talk about, given that I have half an hour. Okay, so let me be. So my plan, I'll do it very, very shortly, but you can then sit down and read the references. I want to justify our statement that the action for this variable var phi is at linear order in slow roll is the one of a scalar field massless living in the sitter. Well, I'm not doing this only for consistency, but also because the way I present the calculation is the most direct way to go beyond the linear approximation. So as I said, so far we studied each Fourier mode as independent. So this means that we neglected the interactions in the theory. But clearly, the Lagrangian I wrote is self-interacting because gravity is a self-interacting theory, and the potential of the inflaton also introduces interactions among different Fourier modes. So, so this is the issue of non-Gaussianities. So, by non-Gaussianity in general, we mean the departure from this picture in which every mode is treated independently. Okay. So I want just to very briefly sketch the calculation that was done for the first time by Maldacena in 2002. Okay. I mean, clearly the details are a bit complicated, but I just want to give the flavor of what kind of calculation you have to do. So, and again, this will also prove what we need. So the fact that in the flat gauge, the action for the variable phi is the one of a free scalar in the Sitter space. So the idea is to start clearly with the action that we discussed many times. Okay, so so we start from this. Then it is convenient to use the so-called ADM representation of the metric, which is nothing more than a clever representation of the metric, or if you want, a clever way to give names to the various entries of the metric. It's nothing very profound. So I just choose this way of writing the metric, okay, which is called the ADM representation. Then I can plug this in the action, in the sense writing this action, but using these names for the various entries of the metric. What you get is an action of this form. So we have H, which is the determinant of a spatial metric. Then the Ricci scalar can be written in this way. Okay, so this is all what I need. So what I did here is to rewrite the four-dimensional Ricci scalar using the so-called Gauss-Kodazzi relation, which relates it to the three-dimensional Ricci scalar on surface of constant time, and then there is contribution from the extrinsic curvature of these surfaces. So this is just an identity that you can find in GR books. So here there is a parenthesis like this. So this is just a rewriting of this term, and this is just the kinetic, I mean, sorry, it's the action for the scalar written using these variables. Now, yes, good point. I'm going to write it. So E is the extrinsic curvature. Let me write it what it is. Okay. Yeah, if you want to be explicit, E is given by this, is 1/2 H I J dot minus, this is just the expression of the extrinsic curvature of constant time surfaces, apart from a factor N. I mean, anyway, so this is the definition of this object. Now, okay, these are, I just rewrote the action. Then I have to choose the gauge. And the gauge that I choose, as I said already before the break, is the so-called spatially flat gauge. So the choice is such that, as I said, that the spatial metric is only perturbed by gravitational waves. Okay, so these are gravitational waves, so this means that they are transverse and traceless. Okay, but let's forget about them, in the sense that we already did the calculation of gravitational waves at leading order, so at in the quadratic approximation. So from now on, I will forget about gravitational waves. So I'm doing this choice of the metric. So I set to zero all the scalar perturbation of the spatial metric. And clearly, as I said already, the scalar field is perturbed in this fashion. Okay, so phi is the variable to describe my perturbation. Okay, now once you have to this point, what is the logic is simple, although the calculation, at quadratic order are simple, then become more and more complicated. The idea is the following. So if you look at the action over there, you see that n and ni, so these two quantities entering the metric, n and ni, they don't have time derivatives in the action. You see, in all the terms, also here, we only have spatial derivatives. This means that these are not true degrees of freedom, in the sense they do not propagate. Okay? They're just Lagrange multipliers. Okay? So what I can do is to write down the equation of motion for these two objects, solve the equation of motion, and write n and ni as a function of phi. Okay, so the point is to write n and ni as a function of phi. Okay. Once you have the solution of n and ni as a function of phi, then you plug the solutions back into the action, and you are left with an action only for the degree of freedom phi. And clearly, this action at quadratic order will be simple. It means just quadratic in phi by definition. But then there will be corrections to this picture coming from the fact that you see that the action is very nonlinear. So I will have terms inducing interactions among different modes of phi. Okay. So this is the logic. Let me quote the results, because I don't have time to go too much into details, but if you are interested, you can look at Maldacena's paper, and at least the calculation is doable. It's not so complicated. At least the logic is very simple. So okay, what do I get? Well, if I do like this, I end up with this. So at second order, okay, which is what you need when you're doing a calculation of the spectrum, the one that we did, the action for this variable var phi is given by this. It's just the scalar kinetic term. Then there is the mass term. Okay. And then there is a contribution of this form, 6 epsilon h squared pi squared. Okay. So this is obviously just a mass term for the scalar. This is not obvious. It comes from this solving the constraint equation and plugging back into the action. Okay. So this is an extra term. But the important point for us is that both of these terms are slow roll suppressed, because this is of order epsilon, order eta, and this is of order epsilon. Okay. So again, at leading order in slow roll, I can forget about these terms, and I can do the calculation that we did in the previous hour. Okay. Yeah, thanks. Okay, that's it. So far, so good. So this is just a check that what we did was correct. So we assumed that the action for this variable phi was the one of a free field in the sitter up to slow roll correction, and with this explicit calculation, you can check that this is correct. Now let's go beyond this and write down the calculation becomes easily quite more complicated. But let me write down the most important terms at cubic order. So let me write down a piece of S3. Okay. So I have a term like this, a term like this. And many others. Okay, so I don't want to. I mean, the result is a bit long. What I want to stress is that I mean, you get various terms cubic in phi, and these are the two leading contributions. Then there are a whole list of terms which are subleading in the Slow-Roll expansion. Okay, clearly the Slow-Roll expansion is still valid. So I want to keep only the leading terms in the Slow-Roll expansion. So you see that now you have cubic terms, so you can calculate the deviation from the Gaussian picture. So these interactions will describe interactions among modes with different k. Okay. So let's estimate what is the size. Okay. I mean, clearly the calculation becomes complicated to take into account all the terms, but let's estimate what is the size of these corrections. Well, let me do it. Can I get rid of this? Or okay, we cannot get rid of this. So we proceed there. Okay, before coming back to this, I just want to do a back of the envelope estimate. Okay. So my point is the following. So let's try to estimate what is the typical deviation from a free scalar picture. And then we'll see what it implies. So imagine, for example, I want to estimate what is the ratio V triple prime over H. Okay. Why I'm estimating this? Well, because this will give me the typical size of departure from a Gaussian picture. Okay. So H is a typical scale in the problem. V triple prime is, as I mentioned, one. So this ratio makes sense. It's the typical size, is the typical amount of. So it tells me how good it is the approximation of using a free field theory as. And neglecting interactions. So how do I estimate this? Well, we know that eta is given by epsilon squared prime over d. Okay. So my point would be that this ratio is very constrained by Slow-Roll, because the logic is that the inflaton must be a very must have a very weakly coupled potential, very flat. And this implies that the interaction among different inflaton modes is very suppressed. Okay? To see it explicitly, let's see what is the bound on this. Well, eta is given by this expression. So the variation of eta in one Hubble time, also this must be very small, because eta must remain small for all the duration of inflation. So the variation of eta in one Hubble time must be very small. And these include clearly a term which is V triple prime times delta phi, which is of order V prime over H squared, sorry. So this is the variation of the inflaton in one Hubble time, and this is a contribution to the variation of eta. Okay, there are other contributions coming from the variation of V, but let's forget about them. So we want these to be small. I mean, actually, this to be of order epsilon squared or eta squared, because I mean, it's a variation of a Slow-Roll parameter, so it must be even more suppressed with respect to the Slow-Roll parameters. So what you get is that this ratio is of order epsilon squared, eta squared, h cubed over v prime by this. And this is another way to rewrite the normalization of the scalar spectrum. So V is of order 10 to minus 5. Okay. So the conclusion is that this ratio is constrained by slow roll, so by the very fact that I need the inflaton to give rise to inflation, so there is not that I can play too much with it, is constrained to be very, very small, 10 to minus 5, and there is an epsilon square suppression. Okay. You can do the same game for V with four, I mean, for the quartic coupling of the inflaton. This is even more transparent because this is a dimensionless quantity, so it typically gives you the amount of deviation from a free theory, no? So it's a quartic coupling of the inflaton, and you can play the same game using these kind of inequalities. So, for example, the variation at second order of eta is constrained to be much smaller than one, and this gives constraint on this fourth derivative. And what you get is that this is suppressed, is of order epsilon cube or eta cube times h to the 6 over d prime cube, sorry, times squared. Okay, so it's the square of this quantity, and then there is a suppression in slow roll. So this is of order 10 to minus 10. So you see an important point, that the inflaton is a completely strange field. So the quartic coupling of the inflaton is constrained by the very fact that we want inflation to be much, much smaller than 10 to minus 10. Okay. So, I mean, just to give you, so remember that the quartic coupling of the Higgs in the standard model, we don't know the math, but it's of order one. I mean, it's not a very small number. While here we are talking about a field in which the quartic coupling is tremendously small. So this is the reason why we expect the perturbation of the inflaton to behave with excellent approximation as free fields. Okay, so for sure it's an excellent approximation to neglect interactions among different modes. And notice that this is just a consequence of slow roll. So it's not. I mean, it's the requirement that, I mean, it's the logic is simple, no? So if you want inflation, you need a flat potential, and the flat potential gives a very suppressed interaction among Fourier modes. Okay? Yes, so actually, you can verify these estimates looking at this action. Okay, one thing that you have to notice is that at the end, the self-interaction of the inflaton is dominated not by the potential, not by terms like this one, okay, self-interactions coming from the potential, because these are suppressed by two powers of slow roll, okay, besides the 10 to minus 5. So these are suppressed compared to the ones I wrote here. These, you see that the V triple prime does not appear. So these are consequences of gravity. So if you want, the self-interaction of the inflaton are so suppressed that they are subdominant with respect to the self-interaction mediated by gravity. So if you want, the inflaton curved space, gravity is nonlinear, so there is a self-interaction coming from this. So if you want, in this picture, there are self-interactions going through the Einstein-Hilbert term, and these are dominant compared to the ones coming from the potential. Okay. But anyway, if you look at this term, you can compare, for example, this term with this term. So this is just the free field theory, and this is one of the leading interactions. So this is in common. So the order of magnitude is phi dot over h m plus squared. Okay, so this is a typical, I mean, this tells me how much this is important compared to this. Phi is of order h. I mean, if you use the calculation that we did, is of order h. And this, if you use slow roll, this is of order square root of epsilon times h over m plus. Okay. you have to, I mean, this epsilon comes from, you write this in terms of slow roll, and you get this square root of epsilon, a equivalent plan. So this is the suppression that I expect. And this number is very, very small. So this is of order epsilon times 10 to minus 5. So this is what Maldacena calculated. Well, so the first result is that the deviation from Gaussianity is of order 10 to minus 5 times the slow parameters. Okay? And it's dominated by gravity interactions. Okay, so if you want to be a bit more explicit, you can write down some more explicit formulas. So if you go beyond the linear approximation, the quantity that you want to calculate is the three-point function of zeta. Okay, so usually, we calculated now the two-point function of zeta, which is the standard calculation. If you go beyond this Gaussian approximation, you can calculate the three-point function. And the three-point function, clearly, there is a momentum conservation, as always, nothing fancy. And then it is usually written like this. It's written like p zeta squared times fnl times a function of a1, a2. Okay, so this function is a function which goes like k to minus 6. Okay, let me remind you that the two-point function goes like 1 over k cubed. So this k to minus 6 is the analog of this 1 over k cubed. It's just a consequence of scale invariance. Okay. Well, what I mean by 1 over k cubed, 1 over k to the 6 is, clearly now I have a lot of freedom because I have three modes that they form a triangle. But there are various expressions, goes like k to minus 6, that I can write down. So the explicit formula is a bit complicated, but it is just a function, a homogeneous function of degree minus 6. So it's case like k to minus 6. And then it depends a bit on what is the shape of the triangle in Fourier space. Okay? So I don't write down the explicit expression, but it's a function of which case like k to minus 6. What else? This is 10 to minus 5 to the fourth. Okay, so we said that this is just a convention. So usually the three-point function is written with this factor in front. So this means that Maldacena calculation shows that for this simple model of inflation, this number is of order epsilon or eta, is of order slow roll. Okay, so notice that this is extremely suppressed, because if I calculate the ratio this ratio is analogous to the skewness of a distribution. So it's the three-point function divided by the power spectrum by 3/2. Okay, so if you take a distribution which is completely non-Gaussian, this ratio is of order 1. Okay, and so this ratio tells me how good it is the approximation of Gaussianity. And if you do this calculation, this means that this is of order p zeta at 1/2 times order epsilon or eta. Okay, so I'm just saying that times fnl. Yeah, sorry, what I meant to. Okay, so I just want to stress that the usual definition of this fnl, which is used to parameterize the amplitude, the importance of non-Gaussianities, is such that the quantity that you should keep in mind is of order fnl times 10 to minus 5. So this just comes from this definition. So fnl of order 1 already means that the theory is tremendously weakly coupled with deviation from Gaussianity of order 10 to minus 5. Okay? And the Baldassina calculation shows that in the simplest case of inflation, this number is of order even suppressed, is of order epsilon. So if you want this ratio is of order 10 to minus 6, 10 to minus 7. Okay? So it's tremendously suppressed. Okay? So you may ask, but okay, my experimentally, what do we know about this? Okay, so now the theory tells me that the deviation from Gaussianity in these models is tremendously small, it's about 10 to minus 7. What do we know experimentally? Well, what we know experimentally are two things. Well, first of all, there is no evidence of departure from Gaussianity. And what is the typical error that we have nowadays? Well, you can easily figure it out. So the typical error that we have on these parameters, it's easy to estimate if you think about the number of data that we have in cosmology. So the best constraints on these kind of parameters comes from, again, from CMB, that, as we discussed, is a very transparent probe of inflation. Well, the number of pixels that you have in a CMB map, for example, in a W map, if you download from the website, you have a map, and this map contains something like 2 million pixels. Okay. So we have a set of 2 million data points, and if you do a proper analysis, you see no signs of deviation from Gaussianity. So you expect, what is the typical error? Well, the typical error would be of order 1/√ of the number of pixels, as everything in statistics. Okay, and the error that you have on the skewness of the distribution of my temperature is of order this, which is of order 10 to minus 3. Okay? And this is practically a very good estimate. Nowadays, we know that FNL, let's say it's for sure below, well, let's say 50. Okay. Notice that, again, by definition, this must be multiplied by 10 to minus 5, in the sense this estimate is for FNL times 10 to minus 5. So you see that it's rather correct. Okay. So this is an important thing to remember, because it is one of the most known things in cosmology. So we know that the deviation from a Gaussian distribution of initial condition is constrained to be smaller than 10 to minus 3. Okay? This is one of the most precise measurements, because even the curvature, for example, which is very well constrained, is just constrained at percent level. But this is one order of magnitude better. Okay? So again, this is a non-trivial statement, because okay, if you believe in slow roll, single field slow roll inflation, then you are not surprised. Maldacena calculation shows that this number is much smaller than the experimental bound, but it's a non-trivial constraint. For example, if you take another model, for example, what I was saying at the beginning, this Planck abracadabra, then you don't know what kind of initial condition you expect, and why you should expect that the theory is so weakly coupled. Okay, so all the theories that we know and love, the standard model, there is no coupling which is over 10 to minus 3. No? So I just want to stress that this is a non-trivial constraint, although it fits very well with the explicit calculation that you can do in a single field slow roll inflation. So I want to conclude saying a few words. So then you may ask, okay, but why people then are interested in Gaussianity? Okay, it's a very interesting experimental constraint, but if you look at the calculation, there will be no way to get to a level of measuring these kind of non-Gaussianities. It's not completely clear, but at least in the near future, we'll not be able to measure these couplings that we calculated in X3. So this is still far, but there are many models in which non-Gaussianities are much larger. And clearly I don't have time to discuss, but I just want to make a list. So there are various ways. The first way is to study modified kinetic term. This means that instead of starting with the Lagrangian as a d phi squared plus a potential, you start with the Lagrangian with a more complicated kinetic term. This in general goes under the name of K inflationary model. In this case, for example, some of you may be familiar with the DBI inflation, in which I just want to stress that in some context, these kind of kinetic terms are quite natural. For example, if you study brain inflation, the kinetic term of the interbrain separation is not minimal, it's not like d phi squared, because it comes from the DBI action, so the metric of induced. The determinant of the induced metric on the brain, and this contains a square root, so it's more complicated, and it's this of this K inflation kind. So it's not so difficult to find models of this form. And what happens in these models is that interactions coming from the kinetic term, they create a much larger non-Gaussianity. And in fact, there are bounds on these models. There are significant bounds on these kind of models. Coming from the fact that we don't observe any deviation from Gaussian. Another kind of models that people studied are multi-field models. There are many of them. For example, a typical case in which non-Gaussianities become relevant is the case of a curvaton scenario. The curvaton scenario is a scenario in which the perturbations that we observe in the sky are not created by the inflaton, as we discussed, but are created by a second field, which is called the curvaton. The second field is a spectator during inflation. It stays there and it gets only quantum fluctuations in the way we saw. Okay. So it's a field which is sufficiently light and it gets perturbation during inflation. Then later on it starts. It has a given mass. So when the Hubble rate drops below the mass, it will start oscillating. Okay, and it will become relevant for the evolution of the universe. And in particular, the fluctuations coming from inflation, so the quantum fluctuation acquired during inflation, will give a different amount of curvaton in different places of the universe. And this can be a source of perturbations that we observe nowadays. In this case, the source of non-Gaussianity, in this case, it comes from the fact that the inflaton Lagrangian is modified. So if you do this calculation, you have to take into account new interactions, which are usually very much more relevant than the ones studied by Maldacena. In this curvaton scenario, non-Gaussianity comes from the fact that the variable zeta that we want to calculate is related to the fluctuation in the field, which I call sigma, in a very nonlinear way. So I don't have time too much to discuss, but there are various sources of non-Gaussianities. So the point is that the relationship between this variable and the fluctuation of the curvaton contains nonlinear terms, which are easily become relevant. Sorry, I don't can enter too much into details, but there are various sources of non-Gaussianities. Another scenario that people look at in the context of non-Gaussianities is the ekipyrotic universe. I don't think Luke said something about this. Sorry, because I was not here. Did you talk about non-Gaussianities? Okay, so this is another context in which non-Gaussianities are relevant, and in some sense they are similar to what happens in these multi-field models in inflationary cosmology. So it's difficult to say whether non-Gaussianities are something natural or not. It's true that in the simplest scenario, if you believe in inflation, you take the simplest scenario, these are very suppressed. But nowadays, they are considered something as a smoking gun of something non-minimal going on. Okay, something like something which is forbidden or very, very suppressed in a minimal scenario, that if detected, they show something about that something non-minimal is happening. In particular, I conclude saying that this function that I wrote here, okay, contains a lot of information. This is similar to the angular dependence of an S matrix when you do scatterings. Okay? So we calculated, and there is a non-trivial dependence on the momenta of the scattering. This is similar to what happens here. So the two-point function is too simple. The two-point function is just a function of 1k, so it's just a spectrum. But a three-point function depends on the shape of the triangle in momentum space. And a lot of information is encoded in this function. And in particular, if you look at the various models, there are various predictions for this function. So it's not only the amplitude of an Gaussian lattice, but also the shape dependence, which is relevant. And in particular, for example, there is a clear distinction between these two models that if you detect an Gaussian lattice, you can also say something about the origin, what is the interaction which generates this deviation from the Gaussian picture. Okay, so I think I will conclude.
Okay, so let's thank Paolo again for a great setup.